is May 22nd, and this is an interview with Donald Kopka, Vice President for Design, Ford Motor Company, in our continuing series on the history of design at the Henry Ford Museum. And this is Dave Crippen. Come in. Testing.
We were all set. We just couldn't put up that.
We have more feedback on the automatic, I noticed.
Yeah, quite a bit.
This is May 22nd, 1984. And this is the interview with Donald Kopka, Vice President for Design at Ford Motor Company, in our continuing series of our recorded reminiscences of involving design history, especially Ford. So, Don, if I may, I'll let you take it over, and you can begin.
Should I get pretty close to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it would be helpful if you decided on a format which would be most comfortable for you, perhaps a step-by-step look at your personal career before coming to Ford,
mm-hmm.
and the influences on you in terms of your career choice, what schools you went to, and
that
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually started my education in the Navy in World War II. I enlisted in the Navy Air Corps and was sent to a college training program at Western Michigan. And after about the first semester of this, the Navy decided they had all the pilots they needed to finish the war with. And I was transferred to a deck officer school at the time. And but when I got out of the Navy, so most of my credits were in engineering. So I decided to further pursue engineering at both Western Michigan and then on to Wayne University. And in my senior year at Wayne University, we took some field trips and went out and saw how beginning engineers worked. And I saw them sitting at drafting tables and in the labs, you know, and it looked kind of boring to me. And in addition to that, my major was in electronics engineering. And after the war, there wasn't any call for it. As a matter of fact, most of the electrical and electronics engineers were out of jobs then. So a friend of mine and I were sitting over a coffee one day, and both of us were complaining a little bit that we thought we might be in the wrong curriculum. And I said, "What would you like to do if you really had your choice?" And he said, "I always thought I'd like to design cars." And I said, "Well, I did too." And he said, "Well, why don't we go over and talk to the dean and see if we could get into a newly established industrial design curriculum there." And we went over, and I got in, and he didn't. And although this kept me in school for 2.5 or 3 more years, I think I ended up a professional student. I finally graduated in 1950 with a degree in industrial design.
Where was that?
At Wayne University. Uh-huh. I was given a job with Chrysler. It was sort of interesting. Trained designers were so unique in that era that they didn't know what to do with them. When I applied at General Motors in the styling, they call it back, and as a matter of fact, the interviewer in personnel told me that I couldn't have it both ways, that I couldn't be both an engineer and a designer and artist, that I had to choose one or the other. And I tried to explain to him that it was a combination of these things, but they really didn't understand it. And he finally tried to offer me a job in their publishing group doing brochures or something like that. So then I interviewed at Chrysler. And they seemed to be quite anxious to try this. Although they'd never had a graduate designer before, they created a college graduate training program for another fellow and myself. I think he came out of Ohio State. And for the first 6 months of the training program, we worked as clay modelers right in the studios and handled the clay, did full-size clay modeling, which probably is marvelous experience to get a three-dimensional feeling of the scale of the car. After about 6 months, I was taken into the Plymouth studio and worked there with a man by the name of Henry King, who was head of Chrysler Design at the time. I went from there on into DeSoto studio. And during the time I was in DeSoto studio, we were starting to fight in Korea. And we had captured a couple of Russian tanks, and they brought them back to the United States. Chrysler was very heavily involved in the ordnance design and tank manufacture back then. And they were extremely impressed with these Russian tanks. They were, I think they called them Tiger tanks or something like that. And they were very, very modern design, quite fast, had good engines in them and so on. To make a long story short, they asked a number of our designers to take a crack at some blue sky thoughts on new tanks, things they could incorporate in a new tank design. And fortunately or unfortunately, I ended up with something they liked, and I was literally drafted into the ordnance group of Chrysler, which turned out to be a very interesting experience. We had a very, very small team, and one of the team members was John DeLorean, as a matter of fact. He was sort of our resident genius. It was before we had access to large computers, and John was our computer, in effect, and John did all of the hydraulics, gun control system, and electronic systems, and leveling systems on the tank. Another fellow who's with Ford Motor Company now, head of testing, was the chief test engineer, Howard Frears, for the tank group. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, we designed the M48 tank, which became the main battle tank for the Army. After that, it was the first time in history that anybody had ever done a full-size clay model of a tank, and it was huge, as you can imagine. An interesting sidelight is that through the clay model, we were able to develop almost perfect ballistic surfaces in the turret and all over. And I think the year that we finished that, somebody invented the shape charge, which went right through ballistic surfaces. But it was extremely interesting. I thought I was going to get stuck in the ordnance group because they were so impressed with somebody that could take our approach to doing perspective sketches and exploded views and so on, and we were helping on the manuals and so on, and I decided I didn't want to get stuck there, so I went back to the man who was head of body engineering for whom Styling reported, and I tried to think of some ploy to get back, so I went over and he granted me an appointment, and when I went in he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want a salary cut." And that got his attention. He said, "Why do you want that?" And I said, "Well, I'm a trained designer, I'm over there in the ordnance group." Well, I was back in Styling the next day. He got me back again. Another interesting sidelight is that I a few months later I decided that I didn't like the way they were designing the cars, that they were too subjective and too superfluous, so I went to the same man who had the reputation for just firing somebody if they complained, and I went and told him I didn't like the way they were designing cars, and he, rather than fire me, he said, "Well, sit down, let's talk about it." He took the wind out of my sails. But anyway, he said if you have patience with a big company, you can achieve a lot. That, you know, small companies, you get things done quicker. But with a big company, you have all this leverage. And he said, if you have the patience, you'll get what you want. And he was right. I finally, cars are just about the way I want them, and it's only been 30 years later. So he was right.
Can you tell us who that gentleman was?
Yes, it was Harry Chesbrough.
Oh, yes.
Very, very bright man. And Harry went on into the international group at Chrysler, I think. He was a good friend, as it turns out. Mm-hmm. I was lucky, I think, because of my education, perhaps. I advanced very, very rapidly, and I was made a studio manager when I was 26 years old, and Cliff Voss, a friend of mine who worked there, who kept track of those things, said I was the second youngest person ever to be a studio head at that time, that Virgil Exner, who was our boss, was the youngest, that he'd been head of Pontiac Studio when he was not quite 26 or something, I think.
Was that DeSoto?
I went to DeSoto after Dodge. I had the Dodge studio first, and then I got the Chrysler DeSoto studio after that. And unfortunately, it was during its waning days. They'd already decided to do away with DeSoto, and I, as they say, I was sort of put in there to preside over the demise. The last couple of years, they just used the Chrysler body and spent very, very little money to give the DeSoto some identity, knowing that they were phasing it out. But they had to do it in steps, because I guess the dealers would have been upset if they just canceled it, so they sort of phased it out in steps. But shortly thereafter, I did have the Chrysler studio. And this was during the era of the wings, the flight wings, and the fins on the cars. And it was sort of an interesting story. I don't know, do you want me to take enough time on this?
Yeah,
okay.
Yes,
well,
we do, yeah.
The design, or styling, as they called it, at Chrysler was sort of under the direction of Henry King, who was a very, very nice man. He'd actually been a hoofer, a dancer, in vaudeville and that sort of thing. But he had some training in art, and he took it over. And he was very well liked by Jim Zeter, who was one of the Zeter brothers, one of the original, Skelton, Zeter, and who was the head at the time? I can't, Zeter, Skelton, and Breer. I guess it was, yeah. Zeter, Skelton, Breer.
Jim was Fred's younger, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm talking about Fred. This was Fred Zeter.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Jim, Jim was his younger brother. Fred started the styling group. He called it the Art and Color Group first, and I think he was impressed with the fact that they had one at GM, so he set this one up under Henry King.
When was that?
I'm not sure. It was several years old when I got there in 1950, so I think it went back to the late 30s, probably. Yeah. It was sort of interesting in that it was a little bit of a show place. Fred Zeter had a lot of friends in high places, movie stars and this sort of thing, and every once in a while they'd come through town, and he'd want to show them the styling operation, but they didn't want us cluttering it up. So they'd tell us that Gene Autry or somebody was coming through, and would we please take a long lunch hour? So we had an awful lot of long lunch hours over a few years. But then they'd bring the dignitaries through and show them around without the young designers cluttering the place up. But the interesting part of it is that Virgil Exner was brought in from Studebaker. Virgil Exner worked on there for Raymond Loewy and ran the Studebaker outfit. And a couple of people at Chrysler were very impressed with him, and they brought him in to head up an advanced studio that was sort of in competition with the other studios that Henry King had. And eventually he took over. Henry King retired, and Virg Exner took over. But Exner was a real purist. He loved the European cars, especially Italian cars, and it was his intention to bring this type of style to Chrysler. And he did a number of them, and unfortunately, that kind of style, when it was on a small car, like a little Fiat or a Maserati or something like that, looked awfully good. But when you blew it up to American-sized proportions, it had kind of a strange look about it. As a matter of fact, it seemed to go back to the 30s, and a lot of the cars done with that kind of a style on the American proportions looked a lot like an old Hupmobile or a Nash or something like that. And so the management of Chrysler had a little trouble understanding this, how these were the newer generation of cars. About the same time, I was in the DeSoto studio at that time, and one of our designers, a fellow by the name of Don Reed, who also was a graduate, came out of Michigan State. Don Reed came up with this wild-looking thing that looked like it just landed from Mars, and it had the fins on it. But it captured everybody's imagination, and he and I started to do a series of those, and we did some full-size illustrations, and more management was dropping in and looking at these and found them interesting. At some point in time, Tom Bannister, who was head of DeSoto Design at the time, was commissioned by the company to start modeling a couple of these cars with the fins on them, and we did several of them. Exner detested them. To him, they were strictly the styling type of thing, you know, and they weren't pure. Design didn't look like anything that he thought a car should look like. But when we came down to it, we had several models that were quite well done, and they looked good because they were low and long and sleek. And we actually, surprisingly, did some wind tunnel testing. We took the car's models to University of Detroit and did some testing there. So they were really quite good. And we were building a case for the fins as acting like a weather vane effect, we said, that would help stabilize the car in crosswinds. Well, to make a long story short, it came down to a choice, And they had a courtyard outside of our building. It was fenced in around, but I went into the men's room on that end of the building, and I could peek out under the window and watch the meeting. And the two cars were there, Exner's car, as I say, which was very nice-looking car, but seemed to look more like something out of the 30s. And then this wild-looking thing that just clung to the ground with the fins coming out the back.
Did it have a code name?
I think we called it Flight Wing or something Flight like Wing. That, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Exner did his best to try and sell his car, but as he was making the points on his car, I noticed that all of the management was looking the other way. And finally, one by one, even during his presentation, they drifted over and started looking at this other car with the fins on it, and he finally lost his audience entirely. He, as a matter of fact, he got upset. He said, "God damn it, I'm trying to show you this car here," you know, and they were all over there. But anyway, it really captured their imagination. Now, I think another fact needs to be stated, and that is that Chrysler was in pretty bad trouble. They were in deep, dark trouble. They were losing money. They didn't know where they were going to go. And I think they felt that they needed something really exciting, you know, that they needed to step out and do something different. And so anyway, as a result of that, they bought the idea of the finned cars, and there were a whole series of them. We actually, once they were convinced this was a good idea, we backed up. Those cars were going to come out in 57, I think, and we backed up and redid the 56 cars and put fins on them, which looked kind of funny, actually, because they were another generation of car, and to stick fins on them looked a little bit funny. When the fins hit, they called it the forward look, I believe it was, and they had the flight wing series, and they really did the job. They just sold like the devil, and people liked them. They gave the company a whole new image. There was one problem, and that is that they were rushed into production, and they were not good cars. They for some reason, they had bad engines that year even. The engines didn't go well. The cars rattled and fell apart, and in a couple of years, Chrysler probably captured a lot of imagination of people, but they brought a lot of buyers on board that were terribly disappointed that they probably turned off for a number of years, so they had to go through another cycle on that. I was still there. I ended up as chief stylist of the Chrysler and Plymouth group, and Bill Brownlee was the chief stylist of the Dodge
group. Did Exner leave about this time?
And Exner had a heart attack, unfortunately, and was quite handicapped, and they brought in a man from Ford Motor Company named Bill Schmidt who to back him up. And Bill had written into his contract that he had some say in the design, and although Exner wanted to use him more as just an administrative guy, Bill insisted that he play a role in this, to the point where he and Exner were at odds. And it finally came down to the point where it was a showdown. And Bill had quite a few followers in the company that were impressed with him, and it came down to a showdown, and it was the president of the company, who I think was Lynn Townsend, Tex Calvert, I guess it was right at the time, yeah, that finally made the decision that X would stay there. But Bill had a contract, and they had to buy him out on it, and to do that, they reached an agreement where they would set up a studio for him, and he could do industrial design, which he wanted to do. As a matter of fact, he had an industrial design group on the outside. But Chrysler gave him several contracts to do advanced cars for them, the next generation of cars. Mm-hmm. And with Bill went several of the better designers, Dick Teague, for one, who had been at Packard before and then later headed up American Motors design, and Homer Lagasse, who was well known, who had been at General Motors before, went with Bill. And we all expected that they'd do quite a job and that we'd have competition on our hands. For some reason, I don't know why, maybe once you get out of the environment and don't have all the effects, their presentations were not very good. We were quite disappointed in them. I think although we didn't want them to win, we expected that they'd give us a good fight. So that Bill Schmidt went on to head an industrial design business that's done very, very well over the years, still quite active. Dick Teague went to American Motors then to replace Anderson there as the vice president. Homer Lagasse went on his own as an industrial designer and tried that for a few years, decided he liked cars better, and then ended up at Ford Motor Company, retired from there. few years ago has been teaching at Center for Creative Studies and now heads the Transportation Design Department at Center for Creative Studies, as a matter of fact. I had, sometime in the early 60s, I think about 62, Exner did decide to retire, and they looked for a replacement for him. Just shortly before that, George Walker retired at Ford Motor Company. George had groomed Joe Orris to take, I'm sorry, yeah, no, Elwood Engel, I'm sorry, Joe, he had groomed Elwood Engel to take over at Ford Motor Company. And they didn't accept his recommendation, and instead they made Gene Bardonet his successor. And George was quite upset about this because he'd actually released to the press the fact that Elwood would replace him, and so he was upset. So he went over and sold Elwood Engel to Chrysler Management, and they bought him, and he came over. And Elwood was still a fairly young guy, I think late 40s, early 50s or something, and he and I got along quite well, but I saw my career blocked with Elwood. I knew it would be a number of years, and I really didn't have any place to go. So at that point, I decided to start looking around.
Mm-hmm.
Cliff Voss, who had been one of Virgil Exner's right-hand men, had been recruited to Ford Motor Company by a good friend of his, Buzz Grissinger, who was head of the Lincoln Mercury Group. And Cliff had gone over there and got in touch with me and said that Henry Ford had decided that he was seeing too much vanilla design at Ford Motor Company. He wanted some chocolate and strawberry. And Cliff Voss had recommended me as somebody that might come in with a little different perspective on things. So began a very cloak and dagger clandestine operation in which I was contacted at night. I will give Ford Motor Company credit for this in that they didn't risk me at all in this whole thing. They didn't put me at risk. The fellow that actually did the interviewing with me was Bob McGuire.
Uh-huh.
And Bob McGuire loved this. He was an ex-Army major, and he put on his trench coat, and we were meeting. I would make an appointment at a doctor's office someplace and go there and meet Bob McGuire in the doctor's office when the doctor wasn't in, and we had several of these clandestine meetings, and it culminated in a fellow by the name of Tom Burns, who was head of administration for Ford Design, coming to my house at 1 o'clock in the morning when we were making the final deal. He kidded me about it later. He claims it was 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. The more years went on, he made it later. But it was finally concluded that I would come to Ford Motor Company and work with a fellow by the name of Dave Ash, who had just started a new group in response to Henry Ford's desire to get a different look at things. We were actually housed in the basement of Ford Motor Company. And we had a pretty free hand. Dave was a very nice guy to work for in that he let you do your own thing and allowed you the opportunity to make a contribution. We did a number of models in that department. Ken Spencer was my counterpart. We were executive designers. I actually stepped back in rank and money to come to Ford Motor Company, but I felt that I needed to have a challenge and an opportunity. Ken Spencer designed a series of Thunderbirds back in the late 60s that I thought were quite interesting, and we got started on a design for a Cougar, and I liked the project. It was to be somewhere above a Mustang, a more sophisticated Mustang, a more expensive Mustang, and it really appealed to me. And I went at it wholeheartedly, and I made some sketches for Dave Ash of what I thought that type of vehicle should look like. He liked them, and we started a full-size clay model. As the model progressed, as it started to take shape, all of a sudden we noticed that a man by the name of Iacocca was appearing in the studio down in the basement every day or two. And he'd come down and puff on his cigar and kind of look this vehicle over. And by the way, there were several others going in the design center. The Lincoln Mercury Group were doing one or two Cougars also. Lee seemed to like this one. He most of the time he didn't say anything to us. He just came down and stood and looked at it. But anyway, when it came down to the wire, they liked the one we had, and it won. It won the contest, and it was the first ever Cougar XR7. And I think that gave my career a good boost, probably because I think I was noticed by Lee. And very shortly thereafter, anyway, I was invited to go into the Ford studio as the as the design executive to run part of the Ford studio. I had the Fairmont, which we then turned into a Torino, and the Mustangs and Falcon and this the smaller cars. Bill Boyer had the Thunderbird and Ford LTD cars at the time. But it was interesting because I just completed the 67 Cougar, and now I was being given a chance to do the first facelift on the Mustang, the 67 Mustang. When I first came to Ford Motor Company, Dave Ash took me over to the pilot plant and showed me the one of the first Mustangs, a pilot Mustang over there. He was very proud of it. David had a lot to do with it, perhaps designed it. There's a lot of confusion in that area, and I didn't come there until after it was finished. But a lot of people said that Dave actually designed the car. I have to admit, I was very disappointed in it. I don't know what I think I expected something more like a Ferrari. We'd heard about the Mustang, and here was this, to me, sort of a slab-sided little car that looked more like a two-door Falcon rather than an all-out sports car, a hairy-looking sports car. And I was kind of disappointed. I tried to hide my disappointment from Dave, knowing that he'd had something to do with it. But anyway, because of that, when I was given an opportunity to design the next generation Mustang, the first one after the original, I was delighted to have a chance to impart some of my thinking to it. And basically, my thinking was that it should be a more solid looking vehicle, rounded off a little bit, a more stable looking vehicle, more quality, maybe not so flat-sided, and everything on the original one looked to me like it was delicate. The little grille was delicate and everything, and I thought it ought to have a little more guts and look a little more like the Ferrari or Maserati that I had in mind. So we were able to do that. We were able to put a whole new body on it that had a lot better stance, I thought, and stronger detailing on it. And it was approved. Before leaving that studio, I also had a chance to do the successor on that, which was the 69 facelift, which used some of the same sheet metal, but put new fronts and rears on it and so on. I was a little disappointed in the way that came out, in that I thought the original Mustang served a broad marketing area, and that it had all the way from being a performance type of car with big engines in it. It also was a car that a school teacher or secretary could buy and get an economy car without having the stigma of being a cheapskate. Mm-hmm. It was a sporty little car, and so they could literally buy an economy car and be smart, but at the same time be a sport. and we started to walk away from that. For some reason, the perception of management was that this was a hairy monster, a vehicle, a powerful car, and they started to make it look more and more like that, which is sort of an irony, because I was trying to get, you know, some of that shape into it, but I think I recognized that it served these different roles. And anyway, as a result, the 69, they added several inches to the front end on it, and then, as you know, in subsequent years through the 70s, it got to be quite a big car. It got to be a hairy big car, and I think they literally walked away from their market with that car. They made it a powerful image rather than the people's car that it was originally, the sporty little people's car. But anyway, after I was in there for a while, they decided that they wanted to rotate me around and give me more Ford Motor Company experience. So then I was given a responsibility for the interior group, and I had that for several years.
About when?
Oh, God, that must be 67 or 8, I guess. Yeah,
some places.
Yeah, I think in that area. I was in there for a year or two, a couple of years, I guess. And it was the time that Bunky Knudsen came on board at Ford Motor Company.
Mm-hmm. We'd like a little some elaboration on this area. If you could slow down a bit in your
sure.
Case, exactly the reasons for you that you could see for Bunky Knudsen being brought in, and how he and his assistant Larry Shinoda impacted on the whole design situation there at Ford.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I think that. I had understood that Henry Ford always liked check and balance in his management, and I think that he saw Lee Iacocca as a very strong guy who would be president at some point in time, but he felt that he needed check and balance. It's my understanding that Mr. Ford and Mr. Knudsen were quite good friends, that their families were close friends and they knew each other real well, and that Bunky was ready for a move. I can't remember. I think he got passed over maybe at GM at one point in time,
yeah,
or thought he was
going
to. Anyway, it seemed to be a good fit. I think that Henry Ford thought that Bunky had a lot of product know-how. He'd been in the Pontiac group and done the wide track cars and so on and so forth. And he felt that he was a good product man, a good marketing man, so he decided that it would be a good idea to bring him on board. I don't think that he was trying to block Lee Iacocca from what I saw. I think that he intended to have Bunky do this for a while and then Lee, and he felt that he had the best of both worlds with these two strong guys there. A number of things happened. I think that, first of all, a lot of the executives and officers of the company resented Knutson coming on board, number one. And secondly, I think Knutson unfortunately picked a bad method of operation, that rather than recognizing that Iacocca was one of the best marketing guys in the world and Jean Bordonnais was one of the best designers in the world and so on, he tended to sort of teach them their business. He used to get them together. He'd call us together early in the morning. I think we had 7 o'clock meetings, but he'd show up at 6:30. So then we started to show up at 6 to be ahead. And I, honest to God, it got so I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, and we were all there waiting by 5 o'clock for a 7 o'clock meeting. But anyway, I think he made that mistake. I think he's basically a very, very nice man. I knew him, and he was very bright and did understand product. But I think he made that mistake of assuming that he knew more just because he came from General Motors. And as such, he built a tremendous amount of resentment in a very, very short time. Now, interestingly, I'm pretty sure Bunky decided that he wanted a backup for Jean Bordonnais, that he felt it was important to have somebody kind of second in command who could work their way into his job. And there wasn't really an apparent one at the time. He did a search, and Larry Shinoda, who had been an old friend of mine from General Motors, as a matter of fact, Larry lived in the apartment across from my mother-in-law in Royal Oak, so I'd known Larry for years and followed him when he raced the little go-karts and so on, and we'd had a number of discussions. Larry's an interesting guy. He's got kind of a difficult personality. Not too many people know him, and he's kind of the guy I feel that, you know, can get pretty tough if he thinks he needs to. However, we had a good relationship. For some reason, we respected each other. I knew that Larry had designed several of the Corvettes that I admired, and I had a great deal of respect for his design knowledge. I suspect that Larry recommended me as one of the contenders for this job that Bunky wanted to create. He was going to call it the executive director and sort of have everything report to him and then report to the vice president.
In the sense that this was bypassing Bordonnais?
No, it would be reporting to Bordonnais. Yeah, but just as a backup, and I think he was looking for some younger talent, you know, maybe a little more intellectual, so on, to back up Bordonnais and kind of do the day-to-day stuff, you know, to infuse some of this thinking. Anyway, at any rate, I was recommended for the job, and I believe a lot of this is assumption on my part, but I believe that Lee Iacocca was promoting Don Della Rosa, who had really had a lot more years there and probably was more nearly the heir apparent. I was sort of the new kid on the block. I'd only been there a few years. Mm-hmm. But Bunky seemed to be impressed with what I'd done and liked the things I was doing. I didn't know him. I didn't know him before. And I have a hunch that Larry played a role in this one. Larry had been working there for some time, and I think I have a hunch that Larry recommended me. But at any rate, I suspect that Bunky got his way over Lee's objections, and it created a little bit of animosity. I don't think Jean Bordonnais was too happy with it, because I think Jean felt that Della Rosa really had first shot at it, as did I. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when the decision was made, Jean called me at home and said, he started out, he said, "Shut up, I'm going to tell you something and I don't want any arguments about it." And then he told me, and I said, "Well, I think, you know, Dell is really, you know, more nearly the guy." I said, "I've got a few years, you know, I can wait for it." And he said, "I told you to shut up." He says, "If this decision has been made and it's going to go that way, so shut up." Well, it was a very, very uncomfortable position, because I was put into this top job. I had all of the design reporting, everything, interior, exterior, advance, and everything, under Gene. I think Gene retained administration, if I'm not mistaken, and personnel, that sort of thing. And there was a lot of animosity. I know that Della Rosa was quite upset, and I know that Iacocca was quite upset. And I had a hell of a time dealing with Iacocca after that, because no matter what I said, he didn't like it. There were a number of occasions where I had to make a choice in designs, and I could tell that it was going against the grain, and I swear he almost bit his cigar off a few times, you know. But I talked to the guys, and I said, "We're in a tough spot, you know." And I said, "The only thing I can tell you to do is let's do what we think is right, you know, and by God, we'll stick by it, you know. If they don't like it, well, that's at least we, you know, we know that we've done right." And we did, and we hung in there real tough. And there were a lot of times when I know Gene didn't like it, and Lee didn't like it, and it was like walking on eggs for a long time. I sort of had the feeling that they couldn't fire me, but I wasn't sure they wouldn't get a hitman out and kill me. So anyway, we went through a few years like this. And
how did it go, in terms of progress?
I think quite well. It was the whole series of cars that was introduced from like 69 through 72 or 73. And my recollection is those were some of the best years we ever had. We made a lot of money. The cars were popular. It wasn't easy times. We were being faced with the new federal regulations, by the way. And in several cases, we had to literally just chop inches out of the front and the back car to meet the weight targets and that sort of thing. It was a really tough time with a lot of compromises made, and some of the results were questionable. I remember we cut, 9 inches out of the rear overhang on the Mercury, for instance, and everybody thought it looked bobtailed, and I was catching a lot of hell for it, I think they pointed to the fact that I told you he couldn't do it. Look at that crummy-looking car. Well, that crummy-looking car got out there and just sold like hell. People loved it, Yeah, I think it was the 72 series, perhaps 70, 71, 72, and yeah. That I'm a little hazy.
Good cars, yeah.
They were excellent cars. They were very, very well made cars, which helped us a lot. But anyway, during that era, cars sold very well. At some point in time, I think that it was after Bunky left, and I've got some thoughts on that. Would you be interested?
Yeah. Okay. And also Shinoda's impact on the
okay, good, well, yeah. Yeah. Larry, that was interesting. Larry is a very bright guy and a good designer, but unfortunately, Bunky made him a director, and Larry had never been in a position where he had to manage before. He was in a nice little experimental studio downstairs at GM and just had his own way, and all of a sudden he was thrown into a position where he had to manage people, make policy decisions, and he was out of the water, frankly, and it frustrated him, and he tended to have a lot of battles and fights with people and so on. In spite of that, he infused people with a lot of interest in terms of performance cars and racing and so on, and did a lot, I think, to change the character of design and get people interested in that aspect of it. Interesting sidelight is that if Larry couldn't get his way with Gene, he would go directly to Bunky, and this made Gene furious. And I was in Gene's office one day when he called Larry in on some specific thing Larry was proposing, and Gene said, "Larry, I oppose this. I don't want you to do it." And he says, "I know you can go to Bunky around me and get it if you want to, but," he says, "I'm asking you not to." And he says, "I'd like to remind you that Bunky might not be here forever," which later was quite prophetic when I thought about it. Larry did go around him and continued to. Part of it was the fact, I think, that Larry just didn't understand the large corporate structure that he was thrown into at that level and clung to somebody he knew and trusted. And they were very, very good friends. Mm-hmm. Bunky had a lot of respect for Larry and vice versa. To make a long story short, the morning that Bunky was let go, we were at lunch, and somebody mentioned it, and Larry Shinoda was in Europe. He was in Germany, I believe. When I got back to my office, I had a call from Larry's wife, and she said, "What's going to happen to Larry now?" And I was recalling Gene's comments, and I said, "Well, I don't think anything too good. I don't know. We'll see. He'll probably have to come back here for us to..." Make a long story short, I was called into Gene's office that afternoon, and we got Larry on the phone in Europe and told him to come back immediately, and Gene couldn't wait for him to get back to Can-Am. And the minute he got back, he was told he was through. And Gene reminded him of that discussion he'd had earlier.
The story that I get is that he actually told him he was through over the phone.
That may be. I'm a little confused. He may have told him that. My recollection is that he didn't. Is that he just told him to get back on the earliest plane,
uh-huh.
And which in effect was as much as telling him he was through. I guess he knew what was going to happen, I'm sure. And I think he told him when he got back. That's my recollection.
Good.
Now there was another guy, Dave Wheeler, who came over with Larry. Good. But Dave was a very, very cooperative guy, and he would bend and do what Gene wanted him to. So when this hit, Gene kept Dave, and Dave is still there. He's head of our color and trim group now, and he's been a very valuable guy. My perception of the Iacocca Knudsen thing is that at some point in time, Bunky had alienated a number of the officers and executives of the company, and Lee helped this alienation. I believe that he literally went around and enlisted people. I don't know whether they signed on the dotted line or not, but I think a number of them agreed to stand with him in what really became a palace revolt.
What kind of levels?
They were vice presidential levels, and he also talked to some members of the board and other executives below vice presidential level. But I understand that he had a number of vice presidents signing up that they would stand with him. And he gave Lee had an offer in his pocket when he went to talk to Mr. Ford. He was being asked to take over Chris Craft, which was a conglomerate of industries. I can't think of the name of them now, but he knew the man that headed them, and he'd offered him the job to take this group over. So he went in armed with that, and I believe that he gave Mr. Ford an ultimatum, that he told him that, you know, he was going to walk. If they didn't move Bunky out, he was going to walk, and so were all these other people. So Mr. Ford, in effect, I believe, was blackmailed into making that move, and I don't think his heart was in it, because I think he still liked Bunky. I happen to know they remained close friends thereafter, and as a matter of fact, it was here at the museum one night during one of the Grand Prix events we had, the reception where they were together. I was in their company. I was talking to Bunky. I hadn't seen him for some while, and Mr. Ford came up and kissed Florence Knudsen, and they talked about their next trip they were going to take together, and then they went back to reminisce about some they'd been taking through the 70s, and it was apparent to me that they had never parted company, that they had remained quite good friends, families, and that this was something that Mr. Ford didn't want to do but was forced to do.
Is your impression, Don, that HF2 never quite forgave Lee for that?
It's definitely my impression. He'd been blackmailed and put into a situation that he didn't like and turned his own people against him. Mm-hmm. Now, here's my perception is, sometime later, Lee decided that he would like to be chairman of the board after he'd been president, and decided that Mr. Ford was standing in his way. And I saw this process start all over again, only this time the target was Henry Ford. He started lining up executives again. He started circulating the idea that Mr. Ford was getting senile. He talked to some of the members of the board.
It was at the time when he was having medical problems.
Yes, it was, right. And pretty soon, I believe, Mr. Ford perceived that here was another palace revolt, only guess who was the target this time.
And he went on the attack.
He just didn't wait. I understand that it was a rough fight, that by this time Lee Iacocca had so many people aligned with him, including Henry's brother, Bill, who felt very strongly about him, that Henry had a real tough job, and it really came down to a him or me thing. I believe that he went to the board and said it's him or me, and won. Now that's a side of it that nobody's ever heard. They think that Henry, in his crusty manner, just decided he didn't like him one day and kicked him out. And to Henry Ford's credit, he's never told this side of it. He's been a real classy guy, a gentleman, and never revealed the side of it that he was literally being blackmailed in a palace revolt. And he didn't have any choice in that matter, as far as I can see.
Did you see his interview with McCarthy?
I did, yeah.
He clung to that.
But nobody's ever really appreciated this other side of the story. I don't think that he was put against the wall, you know, that it really wasn't a snap decision on his part to do this. It was something that built up and actually forced by Lee Iacocca.
It's good to have that. If we can stop a minute and move back to how these events impinged on the, what they had to do with the design process for it. Can you think of a sort of an overall view of how these decisions affected? Did they impede it in any way?
They certainly had a strong effect on it. It's my opinion that when Jean Bordonnais took over from George Walker, George Walker was a very artistic guy, very clever, glib type of guy, and he assumed responsibilities during a time when people didn't know what design was. Literally, there wasn't any criteria by which to judge it. So back in that era, the fellow that was the flashiest wore the brightest clothes, had the best lingo, could weave more black magic and smokescreen than anybody else, was the guy that was obviously the best. So
and that was George Walker.
And that's not to put George down. He was a very, very bright guy, and he was quite well educated. But he was also very clever at recognizing what was needed to be a design head at the time. It was a guy that had to have this image, and he had that image. He was always tanned and drove a white car and had a black dog, you know, and everything he did was designed to build this image. When Gene Bordenay took over, Gene brought a little different approach to it. Gene was much more of a businessman. Gene was a student of business, and although he only had a year of college, he was very, very interested in national and international business, read it, and was well-versed in it. We had many, many interesting talks over the years. And he brought to the whole business, rather than an artsy-craftsy business, he brought it in more as a business. He started operating as a business on a budget. And also, he brought a business to the design of the car in that he was more mechanically oriented and more engineering-oriented and more business-oriented. He started designing cars in which the mechanics and the engines and so on were right. They went together with the car, and that you designed it at a cost that was within the assumptions. So he brought this aspect. Everything he did was designed to build this image. When Gene Bordenay took over, Gene brought a little different approach to it. Gene was much more of a businessman. Gene was a student of business, and although he only had a year of college, he was very, very interested in national and international business, read it, and was well-versed in it. We had many, many interesting talks over the years. And he brought to the whole business, rather than an artsy-craftsy business, he brought it in more as a business. He started operating as a business on a budget. And also, he brought a business to the design of the car in that he was more mechanically oriented and more engineering oriented and more business oriented. He started designing cars in which the mechanics and the engines and so on were right. They went together with the car, and that you designed it at a cost that was within the assumptions. So he brought this aspect to it, and he started to run his whole organization in a much more business-like manner. And rather than the flashy guy in the sports coats that told jokes, they tell the story about the fellow that headed up Kaiser Frazier, Darren, one time that he used this trick often as he was making a presentation. If he lost their interest, that he would have his pants on in such a way that he could just release one thing and they'd fall off. And so if he started to lose their information or was in a contest with somebody else, he'd unloosen his belt and his pants would fall to his ankles and he'd get everybody's attention back. So these guys were showmen back then. Gene Bordenay, opposite, dressed very much like a businessman. He wore three-piece suits, beautiful clothes, and so on, and gave more of that image. In addition to that, he was more of a businessman in that rather than hiding in the studios, as most of the designers had done in the past, he had opinions on what else was going on in the company. He had opinions on management, organization, engineering structure, products worldwide. He became much more of an internationalist than anybody before him. Traveled all over the world, sat in on the planning committees in Europe and so on and so forth. So he brought this different image, and I think it changed the character of the car and the character of design during that era. Now, counter to that was Lee Iacocca and the sales group, who were really holding forth. They were the strongest element. The companies go through different fads. I saw it go through engineering, marketing, sales, and so on. The sales force had full control during this era, and unfortunately, their perception of design was one of rock 'em, sock 'em, steal 'em, cheat 'em, we can sell another car, throw another wide chrome molding on the side of that car, and we can sell for $50 more. And so they were much more interested in the superficial aspects of design and the ability to jazz them up and sell them to the customer. One of the themes of the Thunderbird back then was park a rocket ship in your driveway or something like this, you know. So that unfortunately had a very, very strong effect on things. And that effect was around until the late 70s, believe it or not. Iacocca also thought that a car ought to look as big as it possibly could, no matter what the size of it. And this was sort of a philosophy that Joe Orris had preached, where you pull all of the shapes right out to the corners of the car. You fill the cube, in effect. If a car is 80 inches wide, then the tail lamps are out at 80 inches. There's very little shape down the side. You didn't want the hood to drop because that was negative. You wanted it straight up. So in other words, it dictated boxes is what it dictated. This boxy theme then was further sustained by the need for, in the mid-70s, to meet federal requirements in terms of emissions, fuel economy, and so on. And one of the few ways they could figure out to meet fuel economy was to take weight out of the car. And one of the few ways they could figure to take weight out of the car was to make it smaller. So in effect, we ended up cutting off the front and rear and so on. And the theory was that the most efficient shape is a box. And that's absolutely true if you're building a house or a room. It's not true on the road because this box has to pass through the air and go over bumps and around curves. But anyway, this further sustained the idea of boxy cars. So through the late 70s, when I think another influence would have taken over there, it was sustained by the need to meet federal requirements. And therefore, we had lots and lots of boxes, little boxes and big boxes, and cars in the United States tended to all look alike, I think. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we were at this point, I would guess that the predominant influence was the government. It had been sales and so on. We then went through an era in the late 70s where finance seemed to take over, and all of a sudden, cost became the major consideration. And I believe that they actually fooled engineers and designers into telling them that a given car was going to compete in a level below it to try and keep the prices down. We did a Fairlane Torino type of car that they told us would be a Falcon replacement or something like that, and it ended up being a Granada. And so as a result, a lot of things were done to save cost that in my estimation, created cars that were not finished compositions. They were bare boxes in many cases and stripped and not total cars, not good designs. I think that kind of gets us up to the era where we started to recognize the need for a new approach. And It had two inputs. One of them was the fact that in the mid-70s, we suddenly recognized that aerodynamics could make a contribution. We had a fellow on our staff who was a chief engineer by the name of Jim Shabbat, who had a degree in fluid dynamics. And Jim Shabbat he worked for me as a chief engineer, and he came to Gene Bordenay and myself and convinced us that there was something to be gained through aerodynamic testing of the cars. We were desperate to get every tenth of a mile per gallon we could to meet the fuel economy. And Jim made a pretty good case for just making the cars a little slipperier and changing things here and there that would actually contribute, you know, up to a mile per gallon on certain cars, for instance. And our cars, by the way, were very, very bad aerodynamically at that point. The box is a lousy aerodynamic shape. Both Gene and I were very interested in this. Gene was a guy that loved conceptual things and new ideas and knew how to sell them to the company. And Gene was a very close friend of Henry Ford's and had a lot of sway. And a number of times I know I was representing Gene in negotiations or discussions over something. And as we started the discussions, the other executive would say to me, well, what does Gene really want? Because he's going to end up getting it anyway. So we had a little lever there. Gene, we cut Shabbat loose to start to influence the company with the need for better aerodynamics. He went out as a missionary, and he got some concurrence that, yes, maybe there was something there, but we're too busy to back up or bother with it, and we don't want anybody to tell us how to design the chassis anyway, and so on and so forth. So although he got lip service, he didn't get much more. So he came back, and we met again, and we decided that we needed a task force. So Gene went the next level up and convinced corporate management that this was a good thing and that we needed a task force on aerodynamics. They concurred. A task force was formed, composed of the engine engineers, the test engineers, car engineers, the chassis group, and so on and so forth. Shabbat made his case to them, and they've got a directive that they would start testing cars. Now, the interesting part of it is that up to this point in time, the engine engineers had most of the onus for making fuel economy. It was almost all on their back, right. And they didn't know how they were going to do it. they were under the gun. All of a sudden, when the light went on and they began to realize that they could get some help in this for almost free by just shaping the exterior of the car, all of a sudden the idea was embraced at that point in time. And a great deal of cooperation and a tremendous amount of intensive testing and research went on. And although it wasn't apparent in the total shape of the cars in the late 70s, those cars had been tuned to the teeth, little things, angles, radii and so on, air dams and so on went on. And as a matter of fact, that effort produced a mile and a half per gallon corporate average fuel economy over a period of 4 or 5 years. Now, to put that in perspective, the company estimated that a tenth of a mile per gallon was worth $200 million to achieve it any other way by virtue of downsizing, new engines, new materials, new technology. So that was a contribution of, what would that be, $3 billion, $3 billion over that period of time. And the total investment for the testing, I figured, was around $10 or $12 million. So you can look at it as an investment of $10 or $12 million with a $3 billion payout. And that may give you some idea of why we've embraced aerodynamics to the degree we have. It isn't any fluke. I think about this point in time, I started to realize that it was actually a gold mine and that we just scratched the surface. We were just beginning to mine it, and there was a huge mine there. We seemed to have the lead on it in that we recognized this sooner than the other companies. And I think we did for several reasons. One of them is that the aerodynamic effort started within design, whereas at the other companies, the aerodynamic effort was in advanced or research areas, and the designers resented it. They didn't want those guys coming in and telling them how to design cars. In our group, very early on, we got the designers and our clay modelers to go down to the wind tunnel and live in there, and all of a sudden, they became aerodynamics experts. So they embraced it. They could see what it was doing, how it helped, and how to design cars to take advantage of it. As a matter of fact, wherein early on we would have to take a new design and go down and warp it and change it and so on to get better aerodynamics out of it. As time went on and the designers and modelers learned more about it, they got sort of a seat of the pants knowledge of aerodynamics, and they all became experts. And pretty soon we could go from the original sketch to a model and find that we didn't have a hell of a lot to do with it, that it was pretty doggone good in the wind tunnel. So anyway, we saw these opportunities, embraced them, and started to incorporate them. The other companies began to look at them at the same time, but they were slower to embrace them and slower to incorporate them in there. And we had some measure of that about 2 years ago. The government published a report on how the different companies had achieved their fuel economy improvement. And Ford Motor Company achieved about 13% of their improvement through aerodynamics alone, whereas the average of all of the other companies was about 6 or 7%. So we literally had contributed about twice as much to the fuel economy improvement through aerodynamics than the other companies. So anyway, that gave us the conviction to go from there. And I think it gave our management the conviction. About this time, I realized that some of the shapes we were playing with were fairly radical when we first started to look at these softer shapes. This is before we'd introduced any. And I felt that somehow we had to find a way to condition our management, our company, to educate ourselves to this. Otherwise, we wouldn't sell the ideas, that it would shock people and they would be frightened of it. So I conceived of the idea of the Probe series of cars, which we said were aerodynamic concept cars.
Your conception.
Yeah. Right. It was worked out with Jim Shabbat, I think, at the time. But we decided, and I named it the Probe. As a matter of fact, I thought the Probe was a good name for it. The Probe was a tool that you use in the wind tunnel to test the air pressures. And so we conceived the Probe 1. This is back in, I think, 78 or something like that, maybe. And we wanted to make it an optimum aero car, but we wanted to make it a real car. So we made it a full-size, four-passenger car, about the size of a Thunderbird in that image. And we were told that they didn't think we could get a coefficient of drag below 0.3 on something. And by the way, at the time, the average coefficient was in the mid-point fours and some in the fives, you know, nothing under four. We worked very hard on this and came up with a 0.25, which was just revolutionary at the time. You know, anything that had been down that low had before that had been a very small test vehicle of some time. I think that it served many purposes. One of them was that it did condition our management. It educated them. They saw this car, and by the way, it was a drivable car. It was a real thing. It wasn't just a paper idea. We're very impressed with it. And I think that it helped to condition them to accept these new shapes that we wanted to sell. The car went on to, we used it to condition management, and then we put it on the show circuit, and it went all over the world. It was in every major auto show worldwide. So then we, as an after the fact, we decided that we had three strategies. One was to give our designers and engineers a chance to stretch their minds and do something they wanted to reach out. The second was to educate condition management ourselves, if you will. And thirdly was to condition the consumer to where we were going to give him an idea where we were going by showing him these vehicles. And we did that, and they were very well received. Well, this plus the next probes, the next probe we did was a four-door sedan to prove that you could do the same thing on a four-door. And then Europe did one, which actually was the prototype of the Sierra introduced over there. We call that the Probe 3. And they showed that at the auto shows. This did a marvelous job of convincing management that this was the way to go. Now, in retrospect, you got to realize this was a pretty gutsy thing. Here we were losing $1.5 billion a year. We were talking about investments of a minimum of $1 billion to do a new car. So during a time when we were losing our shirt, on the one hand talking about going out of business, we were willing to risk going to an all-new style, leave our traditional buyers, our traditional image and everything else, go to an all-new style and invest several $1 billion in that new style. That's probably one of the most gutsy moves that any large company's ever made.
Fantastic story. Can you elaborate a bit on the internal dynamics of that decision, who was involved?
Well, that's very important because the who was involved, you know, made it, and it wouldn't have happened without them. The who was involved were Don Peterson and Phil Caldwell. Now, we didn't have much trouble with Peterson. Peterson had actually lived in the design center. He'd been my counterpart when I told you I was executive director. Don came in out of planning as executive director of administration and engineering during those years, and we worked as counterparts. I was the designer, and he was the engineer group. And so he understood our organization quite well and was very impressed with our group. He liked our guys. He said they were the most creative, hardworking group he'd ever seen in the company and still believes that, I think. So he liked them. He came to really understand the design process. He knew a lot about it before, but on top of that, he's a product guy and really knew product, and so there wasn't much trouble selling him. Mm-hmm. Phil was an unknown to us. Phil had sort of come up the finance route, and I knew Phil from truck. I'd worked with him when he headed the truck operations. I had truck as part of my responsibility, so I knew him from there, and I liked him. I thought he was a good guy, that he was straight, and although he didn't come up the product line, that I felt that he understood. The first few meetings we had with Phil, I had the feeling maybe we were shocking him with some of these things, but to his credit, I believe he's an extremely quick learner. And I said I knew we'd done our job after a few meetings. After a couple of months, we showed him some wild, far-out new thing in terms of maybe a pro-barrel concept car or something like that. And as he left the meeting, he turned to me and he said, Don, do you think we're reaching out far enough with these things? And I thought that was great. I could have kissed him. So at any rate, he became an advocate rapidly, too, and was convinced, as were most of the engineering and planning community. They tend to embrace this. As I look back, it is sort of a miracle now that we were able to sell such a radical idea. And as I say, making those kinds of investments, you know, it's just incredible.
Radical,
that we
radical in this country. You're really taking concept of developing Europe.
That's also a very good point, in that all of these people knew the worldwide market, and Phil had worked in Europe, had been chairman of the board over, and knew that European market. So he had a much better appreciation, I think, because of his experience there, and saw these as there was a tendency at first to call them European type of cars. We got off of that. We said they aren't. We said they're international cars. You know, they're our own character, which we further embrace. But I think that's a very, very good point, is that, that many of them had been conditioned with this experience.
The first probe, or the second probe, was a final design for the Sierra.
No, the third. Probe 3 was the final design. And they did a wind tunnel version of it, in which they slicked it up and put biplane spoilers on the rear. So they introduced it as an aero concept car, Probe 3. But they let it leak that it looked a lot like the new Sierra that was going to come out in the fall. Now, subsequently, we've all decided that this is a good technique, and we've been doing a lot of that lately. The Aerostar concept vehicle that we introduced in January at the Detroit Auto Show was a direct result of that, in which we did an aerodynamic version of the production car that's going to come out, tricked it up a little bit. But I think it's a great idea, because any time you're dealing with these new shapes, there is a conditioning factor. And some people will, you know, that are on the leading edge will accept them immediately. Others will be very slow to accept new forms. They perceive that they might be a fad that's going to go away or something like that. So the more we can do to condition people on the outside and tell them where we're going and why we're going there, why these shapes are the way they are, you know, prove to them that they have at aero advantages, which are well beyond just the slipperiness and fuel savings. They go on to road holding and crosswind stability and wind noise and everything else, which is more of my reason for saying that this is a gold mine, is that, you know, we know how to handle a coefficient of drag, but we're still learning lots and lots in terms of more efficient cooling and wind noise and stability and so on and so forth. We've got years and years to go. I did an interview with Jim Jones of Newsweek yesterday, and he wanted to know where cars were going to go in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And I told him exactly where they're going to go, because you get all this for free, just in the shape of the vehicle. Its form follows function, finally.
Yeah,
we're getting there. And so to get back to what influences are, the influences here now are good ones, because sometime during the 70s, where the designer was still perceived as the stylist who could pretty up a car and make it sell better, the company got in serious trouble trying to meet functional dictates on the federal regulations in terms of the fuel economy and emissions and damageability and safety and so on and so forth. Literally, in their panic, they came around begging everybody to help them out of this problem, to solve it, to make a contribution. This is the best thing that ever happened to the designer. During this era, which was hairy, we worked terribly hard and had tremendous challenges, but friends used to say, this must be the worst time in your career, you know, having to meet these things. And I said, it's the best time in my career. We're finally able to design cars the way we all think they should be designed. We're able to make a tremendous contribution as designers. Now, during this period also, a transition happened where the designer went from the beret-wearing artiste, the art and color fellow, to where when it was recognized that he did have some training and could make a contribution, he inherited the responsibility for the package. Before that, the package had been done somewhere else and handed to him, and then he could shape the metal over an already existing design of a car, in effect.
This had been the way it was done previously.
Back in the 60s, early 60s and 50s, up until then, yeah. They started to inherit some responsibility for the package when Bob Alexander came over as our chief engineer back in the 60s, and then more and more until we ended up with the full package responsibility. We also ended up with a responsibility for most of the feasibility, early feasibility, and I don't mean to say that we engineered the car, but we actually, once the design was approved, we put it into a feasibility studio where it went into soak and stayed there for a month or 6 weeks, during which time we worked with all of the body engineers, chassis engineers, manufacturing, assembly, and so on, to make this car right, to make sure it was right and was perfectly feasible. At the time it left there, all of these representatives literally sign a piece of paper that says this car will meet all of the criteria in the assumptions. It will be produced of the material specified, at the volume specified, at the weight specified, and at the cost specified within a nickel or so. So it became a completely different business. All of a sudden, the design community had a big stake in that car, and whereas before they could wear their beret and do pretty lines on it, and then if the engineer couldn't do it, they could criticize him for not being able to do it. So you went from the point where you had the nuts and bolts engineer who had very little appreciation for aesthetics, the beret-wearing artiste who had no appreciation for nuts and bolts, and they've grown together. The designer is now being trained in universities, takes a much more intellectual approach to it, understands engineering and manufacturing, and the engineer has a lot greater appreciation for the aesthetics, marketing, sales, and design. They're more nearly the same person.
Now, that's fascinating. And where does the product planner fit into this?
The product planner has played a variety of roles. Product planning was started at Ford Motor Company. As Don Peterson says, he starts it, that when he applied for a job there, they asked him what he wanted to do, and he said product planning, and he said they hadn't heard the term before, but they hired him as one. Product planning went through several phases. It went through a phase where it was a growing phase, where they were trying to learn what product planning was, and it was mainly in those times accumulation of facts. They tended to be able to accumulate the input from all of the different areas, design, engineering, manufacturing, and so on, and put together a package of assumptions. That's the role the planner played. Up until then, I think it was probably the divisional management or corporate management that kind of set the philosophy for what the car was. These guys actually put together a set of assumptions that described this car, and I think this was the first time it was ever done. Mm-hmm. That was their planning role. And also, then they sort of had the responsibility to shepherd it through all of the different steps that it took out through the manufacturing and out to marketing to make sure that it stuck to the assumptions, came at the cost level they wanted before that cost floated all over the place, had the engineering features they wanted. So they played a very vital role. Now, something happened along the way. in that product planning were the ones that were able to accumulate all of the facts. Suddenly, they held them and decided to release them as they fell fit. Mm-hmm. And so, in effect, they became absolute control of the product, and it was wrong. It got to the point where other disciplines didn't have the input, and they literally held everybody's hand, and they told them how to design a car and how to engineer a car, and so on and so forth, you know. And they didn't release the information they had to the degree that the designer knew enough about the assumptions and the product to do his job. Probably he got a little piece of it, what they thought he deserved. So it went through this era. And at that time, I think the head of product planning was an executive vice president at a very high level. There was John Nevin and Don Fry, several people at a very, very high level who were maybe on their next step to the presidency. For this reason, it got kind of a bad name with the operating groups within the company. They felt that the planning guys had become sort of elitist and that they were hurting the product by not bringing everybody in on it. So subsequently, planning got downplayed somewhat, and probably occupied about the right role through most of the 70s. Unfortunately, right now, for some reason, this trend has continued, and in my estimation, planning is not strong enough or well enough represented in the company now, to the degree that they furnished an awful lot of business planning along with the product planning. It was very important, and also they were able to take these assumptions and see that they happened. They were able to take the assumptions for a particular feature from the design level through the body engineering level into manufacturing and see that it happened and work with the vendors if they needed to, in effect, shape people up, keep them in line, keep things going. They've been cut down to such a low level now that they are not able to perform many of these functions, and I think it's a mistake. I think that the company is lacking a degree of continuity. A lot of other people are trying to make up for it through meetings and teams and a lot of other things, but I think that it's actually been cut back too far, and I suspect we're seeing a cycle like all other things in companies that seem to have fads and go up and down, you know, and I think we've just gone too far down. And I think a lot of people realize that.
Can that trend be reversed, do you think?
Yes, I think it can be. I think it's been recognized. I know I've been quite outspoken on it. We've had several meetings with the president, Don Peterson, to discuss where we're going in design and so on, and it was, although it was design-oriented and had to do with what the cars would look like in the future, I pointed out that I felt that a serious inhibition was the lack of strong planning function, and I'm sure he concurs, as did others in the meeting. By the way, there was really a historical point in time, now that I think about it. When Don Peterson, I think, first took over as president, maybe, he came over and was talking to Jack Telnak, who runs the North American design operation, myself. And in effect, the discussion went something like we were all kind of putting down the current designs we had, those big square models, you know, we were saying, oh, it was too bad that we were stuck with them and all this sort of thing. And I recall Pete sort of said, well, do you guys like those designs? And we said, no, you know, we don't. And he said, well, I don't like them either. You know, he said, why don't we do something we like? And this really, I think, you know, you can sort of pinpoint as the catalyst of that got us started off on these new trends.
About what year?
I think that was probably 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago, someplace in that range.
79.
Yeah. And so he set out to see that we had the opportunity to, he said, why don't you do something you'd like? Why don't you do some cars you'd like to see?
Oh.
And we did.
Talking to you and Jack.
Yeah, Jack Telnak and myself, uh-huh. And that's, Jack launched off on, I think, the Thunderbird, maybe immediately thereafter, and I started doing more of the concept vehicles, the Probe and that sort of thing. And you know, as you know, we have GIA, that is one of our advanced studios in Turin, Italy, and it's an honest-to-God coach builder, and we get we do about 12 vehicles there a year, so we have the opportunity to do some rather exciting things over there. A sort of a bit of irony, I think, is that when I was at Chrysler back in the 50s, Verge Exner had a working relationship with GIA. GIA was owned by the Segres, Luisa, and I can't think of his name right now, Segre, but they were good friends of Exner. Exner was very impressed with them, and they were doing the kind of cars he liked. So we started doing a series of cars that GIA would build for us. They would sort of help in the design, and Exner could have some influence on them while I was there. And I ended up working on several of them. It was quite interesting, and I got to know the Segres a little bit and worked on several of the Ghia cars, which were very, very well received in this country. There was the DeSoto Adventure. That's the one I had the most to do with. Mm-hmm. There were the, I think there was one called the Flight Wing. There was the K310, C310, one called the Falcon that was a black car with some fins on it. And so, but it was an interesting relationship. I found it extremely adventurous at the time as a young designer to be able to work on these cars that were being made in Italy. And by the way, I occupied a rather favored position with Exner back then. I was racing MGs and Austin Healey's. My wife and I both were with the Detroit Sports Car Club of America. And Exner was just a sports car nut, and he acquired a number of them over the period of time. We had Ferraris and Maseratis and Mercedes and everything else. And I was the only one he trusted to take them to the garage and get serviced or anything. So I lived a charmed life. I got to drive these and take them home. And as a matter of fact, we showed a number of those and some of our concept cars, the Ghia concept cars, at some of the major auto races like Watkins Glen, sport car races, Elkhart Lake and so on back in those days. And I got to drive them. Another fellow and I drove them to these races and put them on display there. So it was a lot of fun. I'll never forget when we got a Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing Coupe, the first one. It was actually purchased off of the Paris Auto Show exhibit by Lyons Incorporated, who made wheel covers here in Detroit. And Lyons was a good friend of Chrysler, and they loaned it to Chrysler for a period of time, several months, you know, maybe more like a year, I forget. And we had it, and my God, I was given the responsibility of taking that car up to Elkhart Lake Road Races, which were the old Elkhart Lake Road Races, which raced around the lake. It's since become Road America. But we took this thing up there, and it was like driving a Martian machine, this beautiful thing, and the doors opened up, you know, the Gullwing doors and everything, and it went like the devil. I remember I got up to 132 miles an hour across Michigan at one point in time. But anyway, that was a charming thing. But the irony of it was that quite a few years later, in the mid-70s, when I had responsibility for engineering administration for design, Don Della Rosa ran Ghia. We'd bought it from Alejandro De Tomaso, who had purchased it from the Segres, Luigi Segre. That was Luisa and Luigi Segre. And we'd purchased it, and Dell was running it, and we identified the fact that they did, the company then, once we owned it, went in and did an audit on the way they were doing business, and they got a satisfactory minus. And part of that is due to the way we did business in Italy. Anybody did business in Italy back then. Today, when we have a board meeting over there, and our lawyer will present us with a problem with the government, and I'll say, well, what are we going to do? And he says, well, there's three ways of handling it. And I say, okay, don't tell me the first one, and we'll go on the second, because the first one is always some money under the table, and we can't do business that way. But anyway, to make a long story short, Dell was running it, and we identified some real business problems. So Gene made me the business manager, gave me responsibility for straightening it out and getting a good audit over there. So I got involved at that point in time, and I say it was ironic, after having done business with them back in the 50s, then to inherit some responsibility for it, you know, in the 70. So I traveled with Della Rosa a number of times over there and would sit on the meetings and so on. And we did our job. We installed some good practices, and we made our finance people and design work with them, give them consultation, and also our personnel people, which helped. And we got the audit up to excellent within a year, I think. But anyway, by the time Dell stepped out, Dell went to Della Rosa, went to Chrysler. I knew more about Ghia than anybody, you know, especially the workings of it and so on, and Gene knew of my former experience with it, so I was given the responsibility for it at that point in time, which was really interesting.
Interesting counterpoint. Does the company still own it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, 100%.
And who's responsible for it now?
Well, it's part of my operation. I've recently brought Dave Reese, one of our young guys who's got our international design responsibilities on board, and he started to coordinate the Ghia activities. They work through him, and I just brought him onto the board of directors this year in our spring meeting, so that he's now on there and can sort of inherit that. I'm getting to be one of the older guys now, and I'm trying to figure ways of phasing out without an abrupt transition,
some
so I'm starting to turn it over. Yeah, right.
If I could take you back very quickly to your Chrysler days with Ghia, what was the background of that experimental model which went down with the Andrew Doria.
Yeah, that was interesting. I did work on that one, too. It was called the Norseman, and it was a very, very innovative car. I don't even remember all the innovations on it, but it was a good-looking car. One of the most interesting innovations, to me, was the fact that it didn't have any A-pillars. It didn't have any windshield pillars because it was done under a completely different theory that I thought was fascinating. What actually happened was that the roof was designed in an up position so that it didn't meet the header of the windshield. It was about a foot off. I may be wrong. It may have been 9 inches, but it was something like that. It floated free so that it was structured in such a way that that was its natural position. Then to get it to come down to the head, the header, the windshield header, they used a little 1/8 inch chrome steel rod under tension. The rod was fastened to the body at the base of the A-pillar and to the windshield, and then the nuts were tightened so that it was pulled down into position on the header. So in effect, you had a structurally sound roof that would take rollover and everything else, and yet no A-pillars at all. Nothing in the way of your vision going around the front of the car. The windshield pillars were not there. All you had was this fine chrome rod going down there. There were a number of other innovations on the car. It was a beautiful car. It was black with a, it looked like it had a bubble top. The steel roof itself had a trailing pillars that went into the rear quarter, and they were painted the color of the glass, sort of a dark gray, so that it looked like a complete bubble roof. And it was, we're really anticipating and thinking it would be a fantastic show car, right, and to show some of these new ideas. Unfortunately, it's in the bottom of the ocean right now. I think the company decided after it was down there, safely down there, nobody could get it up, then they claimed all kinds of great things for it. Maybe somebody will get it up one day.
I had the impression that this sort of swan song for that kind of activity at Chrysler. Is that true?
I think the swan song for Ghia working with Chrysler was due to a couple of things. One of them is poor Luigi Segre died at age 42 on the operating table. He hit, it was some simple operation. It was an appendectomy or something like that. And he had insisted that a college university roommate of his, who was a doctor, do the operation, even though it was a minor type of thing. And they brought this doctor in, and as I understand it, he was killed by the anesthetic, that he got an overdose of anesthetic, and even though this was a minor operation, he didn't come out of it. So Luigi was gone. His wife Louisa, who was a very, very good businesswoman, continued it, and as a matter of fact, she continued it with an ex-dictator from South America. His name doesn't come to me right now. He fled to Europe with lots of money, and they became partners. And I think he must have been from Argentina, because he's the one that brought De Tomaso in later. I can't tell you the name, it escapes me. It's one that was well known at the time, though. It was quite a coup down there, I think, and he escaped with a lot of dough. And so they became partners, and again, I think she maybe as the business partner, but he brought an infusion of capital, I think lots of it, all they needed. And then he brought De Tomaso in, who had been a race driver in Argentina, I think Grand Prix level. He was a good race driver, and a good designer, an engineer designer, and he brought him on board to sort of run it. And then gradually they bought Luisa Segre out, I believe, and it was and more and more De Tomaso took over. De Tomaso married a gal from the East Coast who was one of the part of the Rowan Electric family, who was probably the best female sports car driver in the United States, and her name was Rowan first, I guess. And Isabel Haskell. Isabel Haskell, yeah. And quite an interesting gal. I'd met her a few times. And she was the top race driver. I think she drove Jaguars, if I'm not mistaken. And he'd married her. And she had a good business sense and lots of money, so that helped, too. Someplace along the way, Ford then got interested in Ghia. And Iacocca and De Tomaso struck up quite a close friendship. They became close friends. Iacocca admired De Tomaso, so we started to do a lot of work with them. Sometime in the late 60s or early 70s, we bought into them. And I'm not sure, I think we bought half interest, maybe, or something like that.
The Pantera was one of the
Pantera was one of the results of that, and it was produced at Ghia, and Vignali was another coach builder company that was part of that combine And the Panteras were built at Ghia and Vignale, I believe. And it wasn't a very successful product. It wasn't a very good car, unfortunately. It was built in small quantities, and it had a lot of problems. The first one I drove, I remember I lost control of just coming off of the expressway onto a ramp. It switched ends on me, and it was a lousy package. There wasn't room inside, and it didn't. The heating and air conditioning literally didn't do the job, so, and it wasn't well put together. The rear wheel rubbed in the rear wheel well under talents. It had a lot of serious problems. I don't know, to tell you the truth, the reasons that Ford decided to get out, but I believe that Henry Ford became quite disenchanted with De Tomaso. Mm. I think that he was going through a period where he resented some of the things that Lee Iacocca was doing more on his own. Mm. And some people had referred to Ghia as Lee's playpen, that nobody else knew what was going on there, and it seemed as if they made it a point not to let anybody else know that was going on there and sort of did their own thing there. Unfortunately, they used Ghia to embarrass some of the other affiliates. They would wait until somebody in Europe got in trouble with a new design, and then they would come in with something from Ghia that they'd sort of been doing quietly and throw it in and embarrass everybody, and they did the same thing in the States even a number of times with it. So it got kind of a bad name, I think, and at some point in time, the company decided that De Tomaso was not the person they wanted to do business with, so we bought him out at quite a high figure, I understand, something like $3 to $5 million, some place in that range. So he made it well. The guy is a very capable man, evidently. As you know, subsequently he's taken over Maserati, Auto Bianca, many of the famous motorcycle companies in Italy, Moto Guzzi, Bellini, and so on. He's taken all of those over and done quite a good job with them, I guess. I've been told that it's been a good device for the Italian government, in that many of these companies had a group of old line people who were, and too many people on board, and they were losing money, and what they did in effect was do away with the company. They went into bankruptcy, canceled it, and then De Tomaso was able to reconstitute the company with new personnel at lower figures and lower numbers, and so he was able to make them profitable. That it was sort of a device, and he's worked very well that way.
The counter influence of Ghia and the Ford of Europe stylus, that left sort of antipathy toward that approach for a time, didn't it, at Ford?
Towards the European approach,
you mean?
European
approach, yeah, right.
Yes, I think during the last couple of years that Lee was there, maybe, that he saw this as a threat, the European mafia, they call them, this group, including Caldwell. And he saw them as quite a threat, I believe. They were getting high marks for having pulled Europe up by the bootstraps. Were making a lot of money over there, you know, approaching $1 billion a year, I think. They were getting a lot of credit for their new products. And I think that's absolutely right. I think among a number of the so-called North American people that hadn't been this route, that there was some animosity, that they resented anybody telling them how to design cars, and they thought European cars still looked funny. In a way, we were very fortunate that a number of our designers were trained over there, including Jack Telnak, who was head of design for Ford of Europe and understood that environment. So what I see is that it was not so much a matter of mode of style as it was the fact that in Europe they had been faced with the kind of criteria of having to meet stringent fuel economy requirements, high fuel costs, on and on, you know, to get the maximum efficiency out of product efficiency, product size, engine size, and so on and so forth. So they were dealing with a completely different set of parameters than the United States designers were working with. United States designers have been working with the price of gasoline at 50 cents a gallon, you know, and my God, as a matter of fact, people used to brag about what low mileage they got in their big cars, in their V8s. So it was a completely different setup in the United States. In Europe, you know, you get in a car and you travel 50 miles, it's a long trip. In the United States, people used to get in cars and drive 1,000 miles in a day, you know, so it was on expressways, and, you know, in Europe, you're going over bumps. So it was a different environment entirely. So it's no surprise that the cars look different. The interesting thing is that in the mid-70s, when fuel started to become precious and we started having to meet federal dictates all of a sudden the designers were facing the same kind of criteria that they'd been in Europe for years. So it was no wonder that they'd all been trained in the same schools. It's no wonder that the cars started to look more and more alike. But the fact that we had a number of designers who had experience in Europe, and although I never worked there, I had the international responsibility for a number of years and had traveled and spent time and helped them help work in Europe. And a lot of us had a pretty good feeling for what to do and how to get the cars more efficient, I think.
Can you characterize it? I'm fascinated by the fact that it was dictated by environment and gasoline. But can you characterize it as in terms of a design a concept other than aerodynamics?
Well, I think that probably the base of it is, again, that the role of the design in the United States was one more of fashion than function. That people bought new cars because they saw something that had fins on it that last year's didn't, or because they had new colors that they didn't see before, or something. And in all honesty, if you pursue the thought that form follows function, part of the function of a car is to please the owner, that he's proud of it, and it is something that he likes and is new. So fashion plays a role in design. And it's the role that it plays goes from a purely economical car, economy car, where fashion has played very little role because it's so functional, to the other end of the scale that maybe is a Mark or a Cadillac or something like that, where fashion plays a very big role in it. As a matter of fact, in many cases, you could build a case that a lot of well-to-do women buy a new Cadillac every year just as they would buy a new frock from Dior or something like that, because they want to have the latest. They insist on it. You know, they won't be driving last year's vehicle, but they need a reason to do it, and the reason to do it is the facelift, or the change in features, or new colors, or something like that is the reason to do it. So that's the environment you were working under in the United States, and that hasn't gone away. Fashion still plays a role in here. The difference is that the trend towards the more efficient car was one that tended to put fashion aside, or maybe it created a new fashion. Let's look at it. The new fashion was what the Germans call Vernunft, I guess, is the efficient-looking vehicle, is the new fashion. And so that became the fashion. As a matter of fact, I think we're seeing a backlash right now. I think a lot of people that bought these Econo boxes, these little Econo cars that thought they were being patriotic, doing the right thing, being smart, and getting into the new fashion, after driving those things for a while, decided that really wasn't for them. They found out that they couldn't cram the whole family into it. They found out that it didn't have the nice materials inside they liked. They found out that it didn't have the features. Even things like the automatic